I wanted in the book to help people really think through concretely what they could do in their life, and also not force people to say, I have to quit my day job and I'm just going to do some unpaid internships, but sort of what they could do today to start moving the needle, whether that's 10% of their time and money or more.
I'm Raj Kumar, and you're in the DevEx Book Club. Maybe you're a global development nerd like me. Maybe you work at the UN or an NGO, or maybe you're just excited to hear from some of the world's leading authors on the most important issues of the day. Either way, you're in the right place. Grab a snack, get a comfortable seat, and don't worry if you haven't read the book. You're very much welcome. Get ready for our discussion. At DevEx, we spend a lot of time thinking about the biggest, most wicked problems in the world. And I don't have to tell you, there are a lot of them. Conflict, food insecurity, climate change, it's a long list. In a time of so much upheaval, even experienced development and humanitarian professionals could wonder whether the work they're doing is really making a difference. But my guest today, Alex Amoyel, says that making the world a better place isn't about cracking some sort of code. In her book, The Answer Is You, a guidebook to creating a life full of impact, she writes that all of us have the power to do good and change the unfair system the world is built upon. It's not an easy journey, and it requires a thorough understanding of both ourselves and the problems we're facing before trying to implement solutions. But it is necessary. As she writes in the book, quote, you need to get started because you really have no choice anymore. Alex is currently the president and CEO of the Newman's Own Foundation. Before that, she was the executive director of the MIT initiative Solve, which connects startups to funding and resources to solve global challenges. I'm trying to think how many years I've known you. I guess, you know, I know, by the way, congratulations. You're now the new president and CEO at Newman's Own Foundation, which is exciting.
And no, it is. Been there 9 or 10 months now, so yeah.
And obviously before that, you were the executive director at MIT, at the Solve Initiative at MIT. But I think I met you before that when you were at the Clinton Global Initiative.
That's possible. Then it's been, you know, 7 or 8 years, maybe more.
Right. Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's exciting. Thank you so much.
Maybe we could just start with maybe not so much the book, but you, because you are very much in the book. You are someone who I certainly think of when I think about social innovation. This has been your space and your life for 15 years or so. And we just talked for a second about where you are now, but like, how did you get on this journey, Alex?
Well, thank you for asking. And I do talk about it in the book at the beginning, sort of where I came from and why I do what I want to do. But I think from a really young age, I wanted to do something good in the world. And initially, I wanted to be a prosecutor, but that was probably, I was watching Law and Order too much, and I didn't know enough about restorative justice and that type of thing. And then I wanted to do scientific research and rid the world of cancer. So I did actually go and study that at university.
You went further with that dream. You started a PhD program.
Exactly. And then, you know, I just wasn't really happy as a pipetting machine. And then I thus sort of had that little, I don't know, early life crisis about what do I do with my life, you know, age 21 or so. And, you know, switched to international relations for my master's. And from then on was more focused on questions of human rights and international development and things that now I think I would use the word social impact, but I don't even think that word existed at the time as a concept.
I don't think it did. I was around, you know, about the same time, maybe just a little bit earlier, getting started with DevEx. And at the time we started using terms like social enterprise, social entrepreneur, but quickly dropped it because nobody knew what we were talking about. So we found it kind of counterproductive. But I wonder, even going back a little further, what do you think it is that gave you the bug to want to do something with impact or whatever you call it? You know, why have a life dedicated to some of these bigger issues and not just a nice house with a white picket fence?
Well, I also hope that one could have both if one wanted a nice house with a white picket fence, so we don't all have to be starving either around this work. But yeah, I think having thought about it, really, I think it's a combination of heritage and privilege. And I mean by that is that I'm the daughter and granddaughter of refugees on my father's side, and then on my maternal grandmother's side. There was many times where they had to several countries that were abandoned and fled from and losing everything except, I think, their education in the process, pretty much. And that definitely shaped my vision and my life. I'm an immigrant to this wonderful country of the United States as well. When I think about, you know, Syrian refugees, my grandmother escaped to what was then Palestine ahead of World War II to escape Nazi Germany. So I think that's definitely shaped me in what I wanted to do and this vision of equality of opportunity and wanting to be of service. And then on the reverse side is privilege. I'm quoting President Clinton here, but he always used to say, it's quite wonderful, and it's only in the last 200 years that that many people, and still I say not enough in this world, have the choice with what they do with their waking hours. I have the choice with what I do with my waking hours. I have the education. I have many good things. And so, yeah, there are many people who are still surviving or having to work two or three jobs to put food on the table. And I'm able to choose differently. And so I choose to devote my life to social impact and to my mission of equality of opportunity.
And so the choice you made when you were around 21 and you dropped out of the PhD program, you talk about it in the book, was to do what I think a lot of young people in your shoes do. I meet lots of them all the time who think, well, I know I want to do something with impact. I don't really know what it is. So you started knocking on the door of big international NGOs you've heard of. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, and I was rejected by all of them. I'd say thankfully, I don't know. I did end up working for Save the Children, but it for a few years, but it took a while. My dream at the time was to work for Human Rights Watch, and there was a fellowship, and you, at the time, this is dating me, but you had to FedEx your application to them. So I FedExed my well-thought-out application, and they didn't even write back or call me or email me in any case. And I also applied for some sort of fellowship at Save the Children. I can't remember what it was called, which was offering to pay very little, never heard back from them either. So at the time I had a degree in international relations, and I'd had a couple of internships under my belt, but I was still considered to not have that many skills, which is how I ended up at the Boston Consulting Group as a strategy consultant. And, you know, basically they would pay me coming out of graduate school, they would pay me. And I thought the job would be interesting, and it was. And how I truly got started is because they had a pro bono partnership with Save the Children, where they would place some of their associates and consultants there. And I begged and begged and begged to be placed on one of these projects. And finally, once I had done my dues in pharmaceuticals and private equity and what do you expect management consultants to do, they let me go on to a project with Save the Children. And I met a great team. And then I did what they don't want you to, which is I took a full-time job with the pro bono client, but that was okay.
So then you got into Save the Children, you know, one of the biggest international NGOs in the world. What did you find there? You know, you had thought you want to have a big impact. What was it like when you got there?
It's wonderful. I'm still really big fan of Save the Children. They were wonderful. And funnily enough, this role was to be sort of an internal consultant for Save the Children, going around initially the head offices to harmonize their grant management processes and their monitoring and evaluation processes, and a lot, I'd say, and planning and reporting, a lot of the stuff that you, the back office stuff that really gets money and people and things moving from point A to point B, which is actually the bread and butter of a large international organization. And then also to going to different country offices around initially South Asia and then East Asia, Haiti, the Middle East, and other things. So it was really wonderful. But day to day, the job was kind of similar to the job I'd done at BCG and that thing. So that's where that provided a great training ground for this, and training ground that I still use today in this new role as president and CEO of the Newman's Own Foundation. I'm still working on, you know, getting a new grant management system off the ground. You know, I'm like, I did this 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and still having to think about these things. So
as you say, these things matter. And sometimes when you think about your, you know, impact, it can sound very glamorous, but sometimes the real impact are these very basic things, but getting them done right can have a huge effect.
Yeah, no, it's always glamorous.
So you left Save the Children and you went to the Clinton Global Initiative, I think.
Yeah.
Tell us about that experience.
And I wanted, at the time, I was traveling when I was with Save the Children, and I moved more to this sort of field office role, which had a great title, International Change Manager, definitely the best title I'll ever have to this day. I was traveling at some point 3 weeks a month, and I was doing a lot of this, finance, legal, HR, ops, grant management, all you know, this back office work. And so I was craving more the program type role and content and sort of ideas and things like that. And so I applied to different jobs and took a massive pay cut to join the Clinton Foundation in New York, which was a much more expensive city at the time than London. I don't know if that's still the case. But it was to sort of write and think about the content for the big meetings, think about the speakers, write speeches. You know, I was like, oh, this is everything I've not been able to do the last few years. And it was everything I dreamt of and experienced and you know, really great role. And I was promoted pretty quickly and, you know, also fell in love with New York City, which is an incredible place to be. And that was great. And I did really get to work more on content and other things like that.
And the Clinton Global Initiative, I'm sure people listening are at least somewhat familiar, but it's a place where a lot of social innovators show up because the organization has a focus on commitments. And they're bringing together often big corporations or government agencies, but often with some sort of a social innovator. They might be within a big institution or really someone who's an entrepreneur on their own. And so you got to kind of get a very up close view of this social impact space, such as it is. I'm guessing by then you knew that language or would use that language of social impact, but you tell me.
I think we were also creating some of that language. We were like really creating and bringing forth the language of social entrepreneurship, of impact investing, of these different of cross-sector partnerships and all of that. And I did think sometimes it could be sort of esoteric, and certainly compared to when I was in Pakistan or in Haiti, not in the field and on the ground, and seeing how people's lives, and in the case of Save the Children, kids' lives were changed. But it was sort of trying to set the agenda for the people setting the agenda, if you will, and bringing, I certainly, what I was trying to bring to the role was, you know, there was, you know, we hosted President Obama and Bill Gates and Bono and, you know, CEOs of major foundations and international organizations. And yes, those were important people with important things to say, but I was really trying to bring voices, new voices, innovative voices, diverse voices, people that, you know, I used to say to my team, people might show up because they see Bill Gates is on the program, but I want them to come out of the room having met someone, having heard from someone they'd never heard of before, but being transformed by what she said, and that they would sort of remember their name. No offense to Bill Gates, obviously.
Well, as someone who I think attended all of the Clinton Global Initiative events, I felt that way. Certainly. It was, you know, an amazing place to go and meet, and still is now that it's back.
Yeah, it's back.
You know, people you haven't heard of, but you're very delighted when you do meet them and hear of them, and we'll hear more of them. So you had that experience at CGI, which is pretty singular. You know, there's not a lot of places where you could have had that. And then you went on to something that was maybe similarly singular, you know, something really new at MIT. I mean, tell people what that is, because I think as we get into what the book really is aiming to do, a lot of it connects to this last experience that you had.
Yes, no, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, as I was at CGI, I think indeed the voices of those unknown people, these change makers, social innovators, social entrepreneurs, these activists from all around the world and across the US and its territories, was the people who were inspiring me the most. And at some point, you know, as you do, some recruiter emails you going like, oh, there's this thing at MIT and it's in Boston and it's called Solve. And I was like, never heard of Solve. And they'd put on some events, but it hadn't got that much traction, and was not at all interested, I'll be honest, in moving to Boston. And so I sort of respond to the recruiter and I'm like, sorry, I'm not interested in Boston, but you know, the role seems interesting. But they're like, no, you should talk. And lo and behold, you know, how these things happen. I certainly remember coming back on the train from Boston and calling my mother, who I'm pretty close to, and saying, I think I need to move to Boston. I think I need to take this role. But really what it was about and what it became was, you know, taking some of that ethos of CGI, but really focusing it on the social innovators and social entrepreneurs. And for me, what it became about was building a marketplace for social impact innovation, really thinking about what is it, if you centered a program or an initiative around social innovation and social entrepreneurship and celebrate uncovering these people, whether they're nonprofits or for-profits or whether they're individuals who haven't yet incorporated, how do you help them by giving them money, by giving them coaching, but also how do you help them connect with this bigger ecosystem and technical expertise and academic expertise at MIT, but also the big players, the Gates Foundation, the big corporates who, you know, also I think were always looking for social innovation and transformation and new ideas, but where to find those. And so the idea behind Solve was we could be this marketplace and this convener and some would say accelerator. We tried to stay away from that, but you know, that it's not completely wrong to do. And yeah, so that's what I did, I guess, for six and a bit years of my life was building that within MIT, but also, you know, within across the world in that sense.
And given it was MIT, it had quite a bit of focus on the use of technology, right, to accelerate some of these social innovations. Not that they were all technology focused, but there was usually some kind of a tech element.
Yeah.
Right?
So, well, I think what's interesting to me is we're getting into what is technology, right? I think that, and I think we. And what is innovation, right? There's this view, and especially when you hear MIT, you're going to think about generative AI and the blockchain and VR and all these things, which obviously do exist, and you have buildings devoted to that at MIT. But both at MIT and then across the world, you know, we had one of the things I'm most proud of that we did, and that I'm sort of continuing in some form at Newman's Own Foundation, is we launched an Indigenous Communities Fellowship, which was about Indigenous innovators, and to that extent around ancestral knowledge systems and Indigenous technologies. And when we talk about, probably you're very familiar with this, Raj, everybody's talking about regenerative agriculture at the moment, but most of that is basically Indigenous and ancestral farming and irrigation techniques that centuries and millennia of wisdom that has not been lost in Indigenous communities tell us about how to use the land in a responsible, sustainable way that produces health for communities and for the planet. So some of that is, you know, reconnecting and reclaiming that Indigenous knowledge, but and/or combining it with modern technologies.
Are you interested in the intersection of business and social impact? Do you want to know how corporate sustainability, ESG, impact investing, and more can contribute to development finance? My name is Adva Saldinger. I'm a senior reporter at DevEx, and I've been reporting on these issues for nearly a decade. I'm the author of DevEx Invested, our free weekly newsletter dedicated to development finance. Every Tuesday, we explore how companies, investors, and market mechanisms are reshaping the world of development finance. Visit devx.com/newsletters and join us on Tuesdays.
Well, you mentioned that Solve, in a way, was kind of a marketplace. And I guess I want to probe on that a little bit more because, you know, I think of, in some ways, the startup ecosystem for, you know, normal for-profit companies without a social mission, you know, Silicon Valley writ large. And it's easy to sort of understand what that is and look at the trajectory since the first chip companies were founded there, you know, what, 50 years ago or something. And now how that's grown globally into just, you know, a huge startup global ecosystem. How would you talk about sort of the trajectory and the current state of the social impact ecosystem? You know, you've met so many hundreds, maybe thousands of social entrepreneurs and innovators from all over the world by now. Do you see a similar kind of history? How did it start? Where is it now? Where is it going? Is it growing still? Is the sort of the basic thesis behind this space still intact?
I mean, I think it's developed hugely, and there's a lot, and it's a lot better than it was, but still, like any ecosystem, it's still closed off to many people and most people. There's, and there are, you know, obviously lots of statistics around, you know, if we took the Silicon Valley or VC systems and talked about, you know, how many women are funded and how many women-led companies are funded and Black-led companies are funded, and it's in, you know, 1% or 2% each time. Similar dynamics apply in the social impact space, whether that is grant funding or investment funding, right? Whether it's nonprofits or social, for-profit social enterprises, e.g. Indigenous-led and Indigenous serving nonprofits in this country are funded in very small percent, you know, 1 or 2%. Similarly, even though when you look at the need, but also the opportunity in Indian country, it really deserves more. In the book, I talk about the problem solving table, if you will, as an analogy for this marketplace or this ecosystem. It's like, who is at this problem solving table? Still, we need to make it much bigger and more inclusive.
Which seems to be, is really the core thesis of the book, right? I mean, you call it The Answer Is You, and you're really kind of calling out to people to say, come to this table, help design, build this table, make yourself a seat here, because you seem to want this space to just get much bigger. It sounds like you are, as much as you are very clear-eyed, you know, you're not Pollyannish about this space and these challenges, but you're also still an idealist at heart, I guess.
And you have to be. If not, why be that? I'm a radical optimist, but I think there's the word radical in front of that, and we need some big change. And I wrote the book geared towards, in that sense, readers, and then it's an invitation for everyday people, and you know, the young people you talked about who all want to get into social impact, or the people who are established in their careers but feel something is lacking, or even the people who are starting to retire and who sort of think or want to, you know, shift careers and that type of thing, and inviting everybody who, you know, going back, who has the privilege to have a choice with what they do with their waking hours, to really get in the game and to sort of make their seat at the table and to help build that table. The book is less about some of the systemic issues, because it's a book and it's directed towards readers, and I wanted readers to be able to think about what they could do themselves.
I mean, the book is really structured almost as a how-to guide, right? You're taking the reader through a number of steps that they can, you know, think through, sort of tools they could use as they imagine what this life of social impact could look like. And then you weave throughout stories of actual social innovators, you know, to maybe give some inspiration or a little meat on the ideas that you're putting out there. So maybe just take our listeners through a little bit. You know, it sounds like a very intentional approach to social impact. I think I, and maybe you to some degree, we sort of stumbled into this. And it sounds like you've got, from your experience going through that, some ideas you've distilled that the next generation doesn't necessarily have to just stumble through it. What would give us a sense of what some of those are?
Yeah, I wanted in the book, you summarized it very accurately. I wanted to help people really think through concretely what they could do in their life, and also not force people to say, I have to quit my day job and I'm just going to do some unpaid internships and et cetera, et cetera. But sort of what they could do today to start moving the needle, whether that's 10% of their time and money or more. But also that this, you know, comes alive like any stories through the stories of amazing people from all around the world who, for various reasons, whether they were intentional, whether they stumbled into the space, whether they were forced into the space by the circumstances that happened in their lives, that they did get in the game. And sort of, I think that that's what's nice as well, is you sort of get, I guess, my framework and my advice, but also the advice of all these other incredible people I met along the way through Solve and through CGI and through some other things. People, I think, often focus a lot on, I guess, what organization they work for, or that they want to be, that they want to work in social impact or for a nonprofit or for a foundation. Versus taking a step back, and I pretty much start the book or the chapter one with a quote from Rumi, which is about looking into themselves and inviting people to think about what they bring to this problem solving table and what I call their superpowers, and really thinking through that both their skills and their lived experience and all the things that make them, if I mean, this is, you know, like everything, but sort of know thyself type of a thing, and really think about how you can bring those to the table. The other thing that I think is a helpful starting point is, again, without the idea that everybody necessarily is going to quit their day job or be able to land their dream job immediately in the social impact field, is to think about what could you do with 10% of your time, money, brain power, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, you know, riffing on a friend of mine's book called The 10% Entrepreneur, which is about, you know, using 10% of your time and money to do a side gig. And so I invite your side gig to be impact rather than entrepreneurship. And, you know, whether that's volunteering or starting a nonprofit on the side or, you know, taking a course or, donating money, which again, 10%, I didn't invent this. There are many faiths in the world who suggest 10% as the amount of money you would give, or dipping your toe in impact investing or those types of things. Is starting with that and seeing where that leads and what you're going to learn through that, and what, you know, value and happiness you're going to derive from devoting a bit of your time to this, I think is incredible. And yeah, there's a few stories of people who did start like that, who were their volunteer gig or their something they were doing on the side ended up turning into their full-time job and really their position in the space.
I know it's so hard to give advice generically. Everybody's situation is different, but I'm curious what your take is on people who want to have an impact. And so they join like a master's program in international development or something, right? Like they think to go to school to learn about impact versus I think about your career, which is very different, that, you know, the kind of education you had and then going to a consulting firm. And I do meet a lot of social innovators who seem to have a similar background, like something in the private sector, which maybe gave them some of the tools of business model thinking, let's say. What do you advise younger people who are thinking about this career where the end goal is having an impact, but, you know, to get there is unclear?
You know, I did do a master's in international affairs, so which where I did human rights and conflict and security and various things. So I did do, you know, that could have been a master's in international development in that sense. And I think for me at the time, you know, I was so lost after deciding I wasn't going to rid the world of cancer through scientific research that I needed that time. I think to explore life through study. There are plenty of people I know who did do a master's at various points in time, whether that was when they were in their early 20s or who went back, you know, 5 or 10 years into their careers and to do graduate degrees in different fields. So I don't want to put anyone off that. I definitely think that in this day and age in America, certainly the cost of these masters, unless you get all the scholarships and various other things, is a lot of money to put against the opportunity cost of what would it be to spend 2 or 3 years, indeed, like perhaps volunteering, you know, be it through in America, things like Peace Corps. Would 2 years, you probably spend less money on those things, and that might be similar or the same training. But yeah, I think every circumstance is different. There was never a linear path in social impact, I think. And almost none of the people I know, there are a few people who joined Save the Children, like during the Ethiopia famine, and who are still there and who are pretty incredible. But very few make their careers in one job/one nonprofit and et cetera. So given that, and I'd say that's the case now across many industries today as well, we've sort of, for good or bad, exploded a linear career path. So whether or not you go to work for a few years and then go do a graduate degree and you do something in the private sector or more with a sort of hard skill such as economics or law or being a doctor or whatever, and then you sort of move into social impact, or whether you do this, I mean, that's the point. All are welcome, and all these skills and lived experiences and education is welcome, and that's what we need to, if we're going to solve these big injustices and the issues around climate change and then everything else.
Well, I do want to encourage people to read the book to get all of the advice. I don't want to give it all away here, but maybe we can just, as we wrap up, think about one other element you mentioned, because you make me think of it in your most recent comment. And that's this idea that everybody needs like a 10-year plan, so that you know, when you're thinking out for your career and answering these questions, like, should I get a master's degree or not? Or should I start in a private sector company versus joining a nonprofit, that you need this longer trajectory. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about that, because I thought that was a fascinating perspective.
Yeah, and I took that from someone who at the time was not so famous, but Noubar Afayan, who is, among other things, a co-founder of Moderna, which many people might have vaccines in their arms that have protected them against COVID for that. But I think that this was advice he gave me about Solve early on, was not to think that basically sort of 5 years, you stop yourself from dreaming too big and being too ambitious, but a sort of a 10-year ambition of really that if the 10 years allowed you to suspend judgment on everything that might not work and really thinking through implementation, but really going for the ambitious goal in your life, and that then you'd be surprised that you can, that 10 years is a lot of time to get there, and that there's therefore time to make mistakes and to go around the way and other things. So I really like that. And I think that helped certainly me and the Solve team in building Solve, of not really, if we really needed to think about what we needed to fully achieve like next year or 2 years down the line, I think we would have ended up with something smaller and less ambitious.
It reminds me of a Bill Gates quote, which is, people routinely overestimate what can be accomplished in 1 year, but underestimate what can be accomplished in a decade. And
yeah.
And I think
yeah.
that...
Ah, so maybe Newell took it from Bill, but anyway.
But I think it plays out in real life. I mean, you can see it all the time. Yeah, you look back a decade and you think, wow, there are things that have changed a lot in 10 years.
Yeah.
In both technology and in society, and some things obviously for the worse, but many things for the better. And you can see the seeds of those things in social innovators in many cases, who sat around and said, how do we, you know, do something like creating Gavi for vaccines? You know, so there's so many examples, but at the time it can feel frustrating, because it can feel like, well, things are moving so slowly. We see a crisis in front of us where we're not really engaging at the pace we want. But if your time horizon is long enough, and you can do a lot. And I think your book makes that point at the level of a career, at the level of an individual, which is really important.
Yeah. I mean, this is where I'm also a radical optimist, is I believe that every human being wants to do good in the world and wants to have a purpose. And if they were given the choice and the opportunity, they would, you know, choose to really devote their lives to climate change or to, you know, housing or to those types of roles. And how do we, you know, I think at the systems level is how do we give that opportunity to, so that people can do that. But then at an individual level is that when you have that choice, and I'm presuming people who can buy the book have some, to some extent, that choice, that you take it and that you embrace that and that you bring others with you.
Well, you certainly have. And so it was a real pleasure to get to read a little bit about all that went into your career, having known you for a while and seen it from the outside. It was really, really a pleasure to see that and to take away some of the lessons that you've gleaned in this time. So what a great pleasure to spend some time with you today, Alex. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Raj. And thank you for having me. And thank you for showcasing the book and my work. Thank you.
Alex Amoyel is the president and CEO of the Newman's Own Foundation and the author of The Answer Is You, a guidebook to creating a life full of impact. You can follow her on social media at Alex Amoyel. The DevEx Book Club is produced by Lauren Evans. Our executive producer is Margaret Richardson, with assistance from Valeria del Castillo. Thank you all for joining. If you like the podcast, please share with your friends and give us 5 stars. And we really do want to hear from you. Please leave your thoughts in the comments or send me a message on Twitter at Raj_DevEx. To learn what we're reading next, make suggestions for future guests, or submit questions for authors, be sure to sign up for our DevEx Book Club mailing list, which you can find in the description of the show wherever you're listening to this. If you care about global development issues and you want the latest news, don't forget to subscribe to the DevEx Newswire at the link in the comments, where you'll get the day's top global development breaking news, analysis, and opinion, as well as the date of the next book club. Until then, do good out there, and thanks for joining.